because of flight plans and travel arrangements, a lot of people will be kind of coming in during the day in the morning, but we want to go ahead and get started. And I'm Dean Nancy Rogers. Just kidding. She wanted to be here, but she's tied up in another meeting, but she's extremely excited about this conference, pleased that we're having the symposium, and so the first few moments of my remarks are really hopefully in the spirit of what she might have said had she been here to welcome us. And I guess the obvious point is here we are in Ohio talking about elections in late September. Surprise, surprise, right? And there are lots of things going on both in Ohio and around the country in terms of election administration, which are interesting in terms of leading up to this November. And some of those things may be talked about during the course of today and tomorrow morning. But the focus of this conference is actually more of a wide-angle lens. It's not just election administration. It looks at redistricting, it looks at campaign finance, and it looks at a much longer term than just what's going on for this fall. It really tries to take stock with where election law has been, because we're at this time of transition from the Rehnquist Court moving into the Roberts Court, and therefore can project into the future, perhaps, or at least speculate into the future about what election law might be, given the new Supreme Court. So if there is an anchor to the conference, a focus, it is the role of the Supreme Court in sort of supervising election law in America in all of its aspects. And so obviously the recent decisions in terms of campaign finance and redistricting will be prominent. We're pleased, and you know, I'm particularly pleased as Ned Foley, the director of the Election Law at Moritz Project, that we can take this kind of big picture perspective at the same time that we do our sort of day in and day out, week in and week out work on sort of the nuts and bolts of election administration. And as I think many people know, we're just blessed here at Ohio State with a wonderful team of people who focus on election law issues. And in fact, since we had a conference here last September, we have new members of the team that I'd just like to introduce and draw your attention to. So one of them is Nate Semenska, who is our new web editor of our website. So to the extent that the website is serving its purposes in terms of giving people information about election litigation and issues involving election administration, it's really thanks to Nate and his remarkable good work, and so we're just delighted for that. Another new and crucial member of our team is Irene Manat, who I see at the back of the room. Irene, wave, because we really have to thank Irene for a lot of the logistics for today's event. A lot of people went into today's event, as all of you know who were involved in any of these sorts of planning. But Irene, as a new member of our team, has really been a wonderful spark in so many facets of what we do. Laura Williams was new last year, so many of you may remember her from last year. She's the program administrator for election law at Moritz, and so together with Irene has again been the infrastructure that has made this event possible and make really everything that we do possible. And of course, my faculty colleagues at the election law program, you know, some of whom are going to be moderators today: Jim Brudney, Dan Takagi, Steve Huffner, Terry Enns, Donald Tobin, who will be here later. It's just a wonderful, wonderful group of people, and it's just really a privilege to be able to work with so many people as part of this team. This year's symposium is different than last year's. Last year's was our first. This year is our second, and hopefully we're on a nice trend building a tradition. But this year is special because we get to work with the Law Journal. The papers from this symposium, as you know, will be published in our Ohio State Law Journal. We're blessed again at Ohio State to have a particularly fine journal. we sometimes promote the fact that our journal as a journal is often ranked higher than our law school as a law school, which the journal is entitled to take credit for. But anyway, it is a really top journal that leads often in the list of citation counts and so forth. And so I think it's a good place for this symposium to be published, and I think it continues its tradition. I know several authors who are here today have published in Ohio State their articles before, and so it's kind of a reunion for them as well. And in a minute, we will hear from Matt Byrne, the symposium editor. And again, he has been the focal point for this symposium. And I've worked with a lot of students in over 15 years of teaching now, and I've never worked with a student who is as dedicated, as hardworking, as professional, and just a joy to work with. And so I really, really want to commend Matt to all of you. Again, we have a lot of great students, and I don't mean to denigrate anybody else, but Matt has been a particularly fine colleague and really a colleague as we plan this event and work this event, and I just can't thank you enough, and it's been a real pleasure. But before we hear from Matt, we're going to hear from our editor-in-chief, a student of mine, Todd Starker, and who has led the journal well and allowed Matt to play his role. And so as co-sponsors of this event, Todd, I introduce you.
Thank you very much. I'm Todd Starker with the Ohio State Law Journal. I really just want to take one moment to just welcome you to the Prince College of Law and just say how proud you are really to be partnering with the Election Law Grades program and just how delighted we are to publish the papers that are going to come out of this. I really think this is going to serve as kind of the foundation of hopefully a scholarly debate that's going to roll on and on and on. And again, help our site counts. Just not the thing we're most focused on. We just want good academic papers. But I really want to claim one narrow slice of credit for this whole program, and that was asking Matt to serve as the symposium editor. I feel like I've been supported by the email, what can I do, what can I do? And he has just consistently said, I got it. So really, I want to turn it over to Matt. This is his program, and I can't thank you all for coming.
Well, I want to thank you all for being here as well. There has been a lot of planning going into this event, and I think that the fact that so many of you here today shows that work was worthwhile, and I hope that you will find that this symposium is an interesting and engaging event as well, that you get a lot out of, learn from, take things away from. I do want to make just a few quick remarks, because this is my one chance to speak during this event. It's my opinion this event is important for two very large reasons. First, election law, as Professor Foley alluded to, is clearly an extremely relevant and important topic now, given not just the proximity of the November election, but the attention that's been paid to the topic since, especially, Al Gore's contest of the 2000 election in Florida. Since that time, election law has become something that not just scholars here at the symposium pay attention to, but something that you see in the morning newspaper. It's become a topic that regular citizens talk about. And academics, I think, are especially relevant when it's addressing these issues that everybody out there is paying attention to as well. Secondly, with the Supreme Court changing with the additions of Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, this symposium will play a role in providing people with an understanding of how the addition of those two members may affect not just the court's election law jurisprudence, but its jurisprudence in general. Where is the court moving? How will their additions to the court change it or not change how the court deals with cases? One thing I want to mention, most people who are students here know this, as a conservative Republican student, sometimes there is a feeling that in academic circles there isn't a discussion, that you have conversation on one side and that there isn't an interplay between different points of view. And that's something that I really want to thank Professor Foley and Professor Takagi for, was in the planning for the symposium, we really set a goal of having diversity in a number of ways, and that included viewpoint diversity, which I think We have people here from across the spectrum who are talking about these issues, which ultimately can be partisan issues. And that will lead to a more robust and, I think, interesting discussion to hear everyone's point of view contribute to this. I also want to give some thanks. Professor Foley and Professor Takagi have been absolutely indispensable to this symposium that would not have happened without their work, their patience, their emails. I cannot tell you how many, probably thousands, we have exchanged since April. And they've just been a pleasure to work with, and I'm glad that they were willing to be the sponsors of this event. I also want to thank a few people, some who are here, some who are not, but who are equally important to this event. Laura Williams, Irene Minot, Ann Briggs, Laura Landy Carr, Angela Henderson, and I'm probably forgetting many others. But these sorts of staff members have been gone out of their way to put time and energy into making this a successful event. I'm very thankful for that help. Finally, I just want to mention the members of the journal. We have people who are serving as drivers, as at the registration table, everything else you can imagine. And I want to thank them also for sponsoring this event and putting in their time. So thank you for being here. Throughout the day, just a little administrative note, if you have a question about the schedule or what's going on, you need something, please let me know. I may be in and out as I get things that are needed for the participants or what have you, but let me know if you have questions. I'll be glad to help.
Great. Well, thanks again, Matt. And everything I say in terms of thanks, multiply it by 100, and it might get close to what he deserves in terms of credit. And that goes also for Dan, our associate director of our program. The three of us, Matt, Dan, and myself, I think have been a little trio in terms of planning, and it's been a fun group, a fun process. Let me describe a little bit how we envision the panels to work. We're using this square table format as we did last year. We got some good feedback on that style of discussion because we think it hopefully facilitates exchange of views. And so the way it'll work is each panel has a moderator, but there won't be any need for big introductions because we'll, in a minute, we're just going to introduce ourselves, the folks that are here around the table now. Each panel will have one or two principal papers which will be set out and then some additional comments that either would be responsive to the paper or set their own separate themes as well. And the moderator will keep people on schedule. After initial presentations, the panelists will have a chance to go back and forth a little bit, react to each other's comments, and then we'll first take questions from the square table. Folks who are not on the particular panel but are at the table, if they have questions or comments of their own about what the presentations have been, they'll be recognized by the moderator. And after that exchange, the moderator will open up to questions from the audience as time permits. This particular panel, Terry Enns is going to serve as our moderator, but just to keep the show on the road, and since I'm presenting the first paper, I think we'll go pretty quickly into it. But Terry's going to keep us on a tight leash, particularly at the end of today's session, because we need to end right at 11:45 in order to leave time for lunch and so forth. So Terry's not being rude if she keeps us on a real tight leash for this panel. Any questions about format? Hopefully that's relatively self-explanatory. So
I just have one comment. Only a group of law professors can regard this as a square table.
True, a rectangular table. Well, we've been referring to it in our planning meetings as a round table format. But if I had said that, it would be really bizarre.
It's like an O-shaped table.
There we go. It's here we are at Ohio State. O is very big and prominent, and so we are sitting at the square O.
It's better than the S table, which you had in the other room.
Do you want to mention webcast?
Oh, are we definitely being webcast?
Do we know whether we're being webcast or not?
if we're being webcast, I hope it's going well.
Yes.
Good. So I am Ned Foley, the director of the Election Law at Moritz program, and that's what I'll say by way of introducing myself, and I think we'll go around just the square table this way and introduce yourself and your institutional affiliation.
I'm Daniel Lowenstein. I'm from the UCLA Law School.
Jim Bradney from the Law of Ohio State Law School.
D'Angelo Kaji from Ohio State.
Steve Huffer, also from Ohio State.
E. Charles from the University of Minnesota.
Rick Hassel-Loyola Law School.
Brad Smith, Kaplan University Law School.
Linda Greenhouse, I write about the court for the New York Times.
Terry Ennis from Palazzo, Lawrence College of Law.
John 48 from the American Enterprise Institute and the AEI Brookings Election Reform Project.
Great. I wish that this first panel had come later on in the schedule today, because I think it would make more sense in some respects to talk first about the court's decision in the redistricting case and the campaign finance case, and then speculate about the Roberts Court and Bush versus Gore in the field of election administration. But because of travel plans and scheduling, we're doing Bush versus Gore and election administration first. So I think it'll work. We'll wrap everything up again tomorrow and bring all themes together. But the here goes with the first topic. In response to the draft of the paper that I circulated, my friend and colleague Steve Huffner had a great suggestion, which is cut to the chase. The best part, he said, was at the end, and why don't you elevate that to the beginning, make it more prominent, and even think about a new title for the paper to kind of make that the theme. So in a way, I'm testing this out on you to see whether that works. So the new title of the paper, tentatively, is as follows. Lower Court Conflict Over Bush versus Gore, colon, because you know these law journal papers, they always have a subtitle that follows. Equal Protection Law in Violation of Itself. So what do I mean by that? The principle, the equal protection principle that I glean from Bush versus Gore is a principle that there is an equal protection violation when there is discriminatory disenfranchisement of voters as a result of administrative implementation of an insufficiently specified standard created by state law. So that the key is that you have this insufficiently specified standard. It gets administratively implemented. It does so in a way that leads to disparities that cause discrimination in voting rights, that causes some voters to be disenfranchised and other voters do not. I understand that Bush versus Gore is a murky precedent, and there are different ways to understand the case. There's been a rich debate over what it means. Rick Hassan helpfully has suggested that this reading of Bush versus Gore is the due process reading, or some people, including Dan Takagi, refer to it as First Amendment equal protection. I definitely want to accentuate the equal protection component of it, because I think if it weren't for the disparity, it weren't for the discriminatory disenfranchisement, there wouldn't be a constitutional violation. In other words, if you simply had a vague standard and yet administrative enforcement of the standard resulted in everybody's votes being denied, I don't think there would be the violation, or at least the court that decided Bush versus Gore wouldn't have thought of it in the same way. So I think it is fundamentally an equal protection holding, but it does have that element of the lack of specificity. I think this is familiar to everybody. What I'm interested in pursuing, and I want to hear from all of you if other people have pursued this as well in the literature. I have not found it in the literature. There was a brief reference to this idea that I came across in a piece by Mary Ann Case of the Chicago Law School, but not really thought out, just kind of alluded to. And the thought is this. If we see the development of lower court conflict over the understanding of this Bush versus Gore principle. The conventional circuit splits and circuit conflict, the lower courts deviate in their implementation of the principle that I just articulated. That in and of itself is a Bush versus Gore problem, right? We have a insufficiently specified standard. The standard is the equal protection principle as articulated by the Supreme Court. It is being administratively implemented by various local officials. The local officials are the lower courts around the country. They are leading to divergent results. In their implementation, divergent results which cause discriminatory disenfranchisement in voting rights. It raises a question of whether that circuit court implementation of Bush versus Gore is itself a Bush versus Gore problem. That's the irony or thought I want to focus on and consider its implications. Again, I don't think it's a particularly insightful point. It seems to me it's quite obvious that it could play out this way, but I want to explore its implications. And just to make it a little bit more concrete, here's a fact pattern in the way in which this could work out. I've looked closely over the last couple of years at the whole provisional voting process as it's occurred in the wake of the Help America Vote Act. And, you know, one way is that we could see this problem develop is insufficiently specified standards for the implementation of provisional voting rules, and particularly when those ballots, those provisional ballots, get counted because they are cast by eligible voters versus when they get rejected because of a defect. And so most state statutes at this point, even after the problems that occurred in 2004, have not developed the kind of specificity that the Supreme Court was looking for when it said, you know, a dimple chat gets treated this way, not that way, hanging chat, et cetera. You know, we don't have that kind of specificity on provisional ballots. On the contrary, most state laws simply say, you know, count a provisional ballot when it's cast by a registered voter. And we've seen discrepancies, deviations in the way in which local officials take that charge in many different ways. It can be as simple as how they check signatures. And so there can be stricter review of the signatures on a provisional ballot envelope and how it's compared to the signature on file in some jurisdiction than in others. But even as just the checking of records deviates from one location to another. So, for example, some local officials only check the electronic database to see whether the voter is listed as a registered voter. Other local officials do a double check of the original registration card. And in fact, this was prominent in the Washington gubernatorial election, where there was litigation over the necessity to create equal treatment. And for those counties that were only checking electronic records to go double check cards, in fact, new votes were found, and that's what ultimately gave the election in the third recount to the Democratic candidate Christine Gregoire, because she had been behind before those additional ballots were counted. That was just phase one of the governor's litigation. But anyway, I think you see the illustration that there can be disparities in the counting of provisional ballots, and that could raise a question of whether that kind of disparity is a violation of the principle of Bush versus Gore. And the point here is that lower courts may well come to different conclusions over that question as it'll occur in different states. We've seen provisional ballot litigation raising Bush versus Gore issues in Washington, in Ohio, in other states. And so the more and more we get used to this notion of provisional balloting this year and in the future, we're likely to see more and more litigation of this kind. And of course, it's only one species of this litigation involving insufficiently specified standards. The matching criteria for electronic databases is another aspect where this could come up, voter ID, and so forth. So it's quite likely that we're going to see lower court conflict over the meaning of Bush versus Gore. There are reasonable arguments as to why provisional voting is different from the hanging chad, dimple chad problem. We can discuss this in Q&A and so forth. It's in the paper, but the notion is the lack of a specified standard may be more problematic in one aspect of election administration than other. It may be more difficult to come up with a specified standard with respect to some issues than others. Signature matching, for example, may be very hard to create specified standards for in the way that you could decide this is what you do with a dimple chad, this is what you do with a hanging chad. What do you do when the signature looks a little bit different, other T's cross the same way? The handwriting experts may say that's not susceptible to, pre-designed rules. There is a feasibility notion, I think, in Bush versus Gore. Again, it's not very well spelled out, but the court talks about the need for specified standards when it's feasible to create them. So there can be litigation over degrees of feasibility as well as degrees of specificity. And so a lot of room for litigation, a lot of room for variation among lower courts in good faith attempting to understand what the principle means. And therefore, it's likely that we could have this situation where we've got lower court conflict over the implementation of this insufficiently specified standard, namely Bush versus Gore itself. Now, maybe this is just a cute point. Bush versus Gore violates itself. Oh, how funny. I think it's more important than that, and that's why it's the focus of my paper. I think this irony, if it's an accurate description, should this conflict arise, may weigh in the public discussion of when the court should grant certiorari to take the next Bush versus Gore case. In other words, the court in control of its own docket is going to be faced with cert petitions raising Bush versus Gore claims. They already have one out of the 11th Circuit that involves sort of a different Bush versus Gore problem. It's not about insufficiently specified standards. It's about something else. We can get into that. But they're going to be the gatekeeper of these petitions. The court's general instinct, as people know, is to wait before taking cases. Let conflicts develop. Let issues percolate in the lower courts. Let that conflict get deep, sustained, and clearly emerging rather than jump into things. That happens in all sorts of areas of the law. But there's reasons to think that the court would be particularly wanting to wait on Bush versus Gore, particularly reluctant to take a case, just because of the nature of that decision itself. It was controversial, a lot of bad feeling in the internal dynamics of the court, raw nerve in the public. And so, human nature being what it is, the court, thinking about its own docket, could say we are actually doing the country a favor if we hold off for a long time before we revisit Bush versus Gore and what it means. And if that's the general disposition on the part of the court in thinking about this, then that would suggest we are going to have to wait and see this lower court conflict emerge and emerge in a deep, sustained way before the court would enter into the picture. So weigh that factor against this irony point. In other words, if the argument gets made, hey, wait a second, waiting around for this conflict to develop is itself a Bush versus Gore violation, is that going to affect the court's own calculus about the timing of when it takes one of these cases? That, I think, is an interesting, again, it's very speculative in nature, but I think it's an interesting thing to think about. I also think there's another factor that's worth putting into the mix of this discussion, and that is concern about public distrust over the integrity of the electoral process itself. This is something that, weighs heavily on my mind just in general as we see all these concerns about machines breaking down and hackable electronic machines and paper trails, 10% of which are destroyed and so can't be counted. I mean, there's a lot of, John and I both were at a panel in Washington just a week ago today where
we were depressed.
We were nervous, depressed, and anxious just about the election administration process for reasons that had nothing to do with Bush versus Gore. But that general anxiety about our voting administration system may also affect this calculation about when to grant cert on one of these kinds of cases. Because part of my thesis in the paper is that letting this normal circuit court conflict percolate and develop as the court would be inclined to do will increase public anxiety and distrust about the election machinery. The public doesn't like election litigation. Litigation over election rules, particularly about the voting process itself, makes the public nervous because it feeds in to the notion that there's something wrong with the system's broken and it's not being fixed. This is particularly true about post-election day litigation, something that Sam and Zakharov and I have talked about from time to time, but you know, and other people, Rick Hassan has mentioned this and Dan Takagi, a lot of people share the view that the worst form of litigation over voting rules is litigation that occurs after ballots are cast. And of course, that was the Bush versus Gore scenario. That would be the scenario involving provisional ballots. And so that's a likely context in which these issues are going to arise. But I think regardless of when litigation occurs, if it's litigation over the voting process and you see circuit conflict about that litigation, that's a suggestion that the system can't fix itself, right? If you have courts in disagreement about how to handle these issues, and there's that sense of disarray that feeds into the anxiety that the election law system is not able to handle these issues. So now it seems to me that we have sort of two factors at work on one side of this cert grant equation, balanced against the normal desire to hold off, coupled with the particular aversion to revisit Bush versus Gore. So you've got two things weighing to keep the cases away from the court. Then you've got two things, I think, weighing in favor of an earlier grant than would otherwise occur. One is this irony notion that to let this conflict be out there kind of violates the spirit, if not the reality, of Bush versus Gore itself. And second, this fear that letting the conflict develop will increase public distrust. You know, I don't know how ultimately that will weigh out in terms of grant, and of course it depends on which case gets to the court first and what time and so forth. But I would like to think that the public distrust issue and this point about the irony of the conflict violating Bush versus Gore itself would accelerate the timetable. In other words, that would cause the court to take a case sooner than we might otherwise expect. So that's kind of the basic point. The only thing I want to do now in just a couple minutes remaining is circle back over how I got myself to writing about the cert grant process. That was not my intention when I went into this paper. Instead, my original goal had been to ask what the Roberts Court should do with Bush versus Gore as a precedent, how to take it seriously. It was almost a Ronald Dworkin-like inquiry, for those of you who are familiar with his work, and the notion of the ideal judge just trying to get it right. You know, what is the right answer to the meaning of Bush versus Gore and how it should apply to all these various cases likely to come up? And I ultimately concluded that that was not a valid or not a worthwhile enterprise sort of at this stage in the life cycle of Bush versus Gore for a variety of reasons. There are just too many different fact patterns that are emerging out there. The inquiry is too fact intensive. Again, it depends on what we really mean by excessive discretion or excessive lack of specificity. Insufficient. You know, that's like undue burden in the abortion area. How is a burden undue? Or when does a law become disproportional or incongruent under Section 5? You know, or when are contribution limits too low? I mean, there are just a lot of tests out there which are so fact-intensive, it's hard to apply a Dworkin-like right-answer thesis to those sorts of questions. And indeed, and this may be a little bit more controversial, but maybe not, The lack of specificity in Bush versus Gore itself suggests that reasonable jurists could reach opposite conclusions on these issues to the point where, you know, it would be really wrong to say there is only one right answer, that the Dworkin approach just doesn't hold up when you have a kind of case like this. And I, by the way, I don't think this is a result of that single sentence in Bush versus Gore, which says this case applies, you know, we're only looking at today, not tomorrow. This is, you know, limited to today only. I don't think that's the critical feature that causes this problem. I think it's actually the nature of the test that's there, to the extent that there is one, is underspecified in the way that I've talked about. And then finally, the other reason why I think we can't really do the Dworkin enterprise is the notion of path dependency. The right answer to the resolution of any particular case coming up under Bush versus Gore may depend upon the order in which the cases arise. There's a rich array of Bush versus Gore problems that are waiting to be developed out there. The lack of specificity is only one, and I'd be happy, you know, in response to Q&A to catalog, there are at least three others that I can identify. And my own understanding of the merits of each of those subcategories is dependent upon the precedents that get set with respect to each of those subcategories. So there's a kind of path dependency in terms of how these cases get to the court. And so ultimately I thought, let's not focus on the merits of these claims. Let's focus on the timing. When are they going to get to the Supreme Court? Who is going to be the composition of the court? Is it going to be the nine justices who are there now? Or is it going to be a different cast of characters? Is it going to be within the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years before we really get elucidation of this law? And it was that thought that it might take more than a decade. We might have this kind of uncertainty about what Bush-Gore means for a long time, which fed into this notion of public distrust and anxiety, the sense that the law of voting administration is itself lawless, at least in one key feature, is a concern. It's not completely lawless, but one aspect of election law is kind of lacking the clarity that we need, and what dynamic will that have on our public consciousness of the integrity of the electoral system. And that was the entry into the paper, and that ultimately led to this point about the irony of a conflict violating Bush versus Gore itself.
Thank you. I was present at the conference here a year ago where, oddly, in an odd-numbered year, we were quite focused on impending elections, especially in Ohio and California. It was a very fine conference. I was terribly impressed with the Election Law Center here, with the people here, and I enjoyed the conference very much, and so I am very, very grateful to be invited back again this year, when oddly in an even-numbered year we are less focused on the impending election, but I think there's value in both. Ned's paper is very much worth reading. It's just got a lot of virtues in it, including some that are quite characteristic of his writing in general. There's very good judgment in the paper. He does an excellent job of sorting out a lot of things. In some ways, I think that was the most helpful aspect of the paper for me, just sorting out things, putting them in place, arranging things in order. He values some things more than others, and I think generally, even if I may, for example, on the kinds of things that should be, that should create constitutional issues under Bush versus Gore, I'm much further over on the spectrum than he is. I don't think they should, and he thinks some of them should, but I think the way he orders them is quite helpful to me, and it's a valuable paper in that sense. It covers a lot of ground, and another virtue of the paper, and one that creates difficulty for me in commenting on it here, is that it just causes you, or at least caused me, to think about so many things. It's a very thought-provoking paper, and I recommend it to you. I'm just going to try to mention three things thoughts that were prompted by the paper, two of which are, in a way, the first two are standing back from the paper. The third, if I have time for it, we'll get a little more into the whoop and wharf of the paper. The first comment is, I think, in a way, the underlying question, or a way to look at the underlying question in all of this area of consideration, is
What's the boundary between administration and constitutional rights, which might be cast as equal protection rights or civil rights or voting rights or whatever? To some extent, but I think a very limited extent, that might be regarded as an epistemological question. That is to say, maybe there's an essence of administrative questions and an essence of constitutional rights questions, and we should try to separate them out. But I think that when you think about it, they really, in a way, it's not that. They're not separate phenomena. They're enormously overlapping, maybe congruent. It's just a different way to look at the same phenomena. Anytime an election official does something, in one way or another, it's going to affect people's ability to vote or to have their votes cast or counted or something. And so it's more a question of in which situations is it more useful to think of it as an administrative question, and which is it more useful to think of it as a legal question that should be litigated under the Constitution. And my general approach is to think to be very skeptical of the idea that treating these as constitutional questions can be very helpful beyond a fairly limited domain. Unfortunately, not an easy domain define or to carve out in a specific way. But I think that the best approach in general to the range of problems that Ned and others are talking about is to try to professionalize the administration rather than have courts and lawyers coming in and adjudicating all of these things. And that, I think, we could talk about that at length. I have a lot of reasons for that, and others have reasons for not seeing it that way, and we could and perhaps should discuss that at some length. But I think that there's a kind of an attitudinal spectrum, and you could be at different places, and that will affect the way you see these issues. The second question I want to address, and obviously I'm running through these very briefly, at least by my standards, and is what Bush versus Gore means. And the reason, I'm going to disagree with Ned, but the reason this isn't really a comment on the paper is that Ned's view is the same as almost everybody's, or certainly most of the commentators, and I guess just about every court that's considered it. But I don't think it should be taken for granted, and that is that the equal protection aspect of Bush versus Gore is dealing with election administration. I don't think it is. I think Bush versus Gore is best seen as a case about equal protection within a certain kind of judicial proceedings. A key phrase that everybody uses and that Ned quotes at page 9 of his paper is the decision in Bush versus Gore, there's a quotation from the case, was, quote, limited to the present circumstances, for the problem of equal protection in election processes generally presents many complexities. And I think that the sort of general approach that probably Ned would take and that most commentators would take is one problem is that's in one part of the opinion, and earlier in the opinion there are these grand general statements about how fundamental the right to vote is and how that's at stake and drawing on big major cases like Reynolds and Harper. And so maybe the approach, and I hope this is not a caricature, it's obviously a simplification, is to say, well, we got this, you know, the one statement and some others that look very narrow, we got the broad statements, so maybe we sort of average them out and we figure that what the case means is this isn't really limited just to the present circumstances, but it's also not an invitation for judges to just run the system, but it's somewhere in between. It's narrow, but not too narrow. I think that's sort of the consensual approach. But I think that there's a better way to look at it. That's not very satisfying as a matter of textual interpretation. Now, when they say limited to the present circumstances, one reason that is rejected is that's read as meaning limited to the year 2000, limited to presidential candidates whose names are Al Gore and George Bush and so on and so forth. But that's not a friendly interpretation, because if that's what the court meant, that's lawless. The whole point of the common law system is that an appellate court can't do that, that an appellate court can decide a case. It then is up for grabs as to what is the principle of that case, how broad, how narrow, et cetera. But you can't just say this is for these parties and for nobody else. So I think a friendlier interpretation is to read it as meaning it's limited to this kind of circumstances. But then, of course, that opens the question that's always open. Yeah, but kind, define how, narrowly, broadly, et cetera. My answer to that would be to the setting. This is a case in which a court is ordering a statewide recount. And within that framework, distinct ballots that have exactly the same characteristics are being treated differently. And I think it makes a lot of sense to say that's what the circumstances are, and that within that framework, these are not just pieces of paper that are evidence of something. They are evidence of votes, or they are votes. And so within that framework, we are influenced by the fundamental importance of what is at stake. But the circumstances that the case applies to are circumstances of judicial proceedings in which one election is being dealt with. There's a lot more to be said about that, but I'll just pass on to the last point, which is what Ned today said he's going to sort of bring front and center, and that's this whole question of the problem of disparity in the way Bush versus Gore is being treated. And since my time is almost out, I'll just say that I think it's a little overdrawn, especially I think it's overdrawn when he talks about public confidence. I think that when these cases come up, such as in Washington, Democrats, you know, activists, politically conscious Democrats, see it purely in terms of the Democrats should win. Everything that goes in that direction is right. Republicans, just the opposite. And the average voter just figures they will resolve it, you know, and go on with their business. I don't think there's anybody who sits there and says, oh, my God, Michigan, they did this, and Wisconsin, they did that, and are we going to do the Michigan way or the Wisconsin way? I just don't think that is a perceptible public sentiment. I think this is another virtue of Ned's writing, including this paper, is that he always sort of presents you with the whole situation, and he gives you the grounds on which you can disagree with him if you choose to do so. And I think that's a very, very good quality in academic writing. And here he makes the point. He calls it a meta. I forget what comes after meta, but it's at a meta level. That is to say, it's not the controversy itself, it's the way different kinds of controversies are resolved. And I think that, there are all kinds of problems with the uncertainty that exists here and elsewhere in elections, but I'm just not persuaded that that it's especially a problem that courts in one state might be interpreting Bush versus Gore differently than in another state. Now, having said that, within that discussion, there's so much that Ned says that I agree with or that I find really provocative or interesting or helpful in sorting things out. But just in terms of that aspect of it, I'm not entirely persuaded by that.
Thank you. Thank you to Moritz for having me here. The hospitality already and the short time I've been here has been great. I was picked up at the airport very late last night. I stayed, interestingly, I think appropriately for this conference, in the Ken Blackwell Hotel last night.
It's named after another controversial figure in Ohio life. But
I was a little worried when I tried to check in and they couldn't find my registration, told me I couldn't get into one of their very nice provisional rooms because I was registered at the Super 8 down the highway. And so if there's one thing that this very diverse conference, I think we could all agree on by the end of the weekend, is that we should have nonpartisan hotel administration. Very important. It is a sordid thing that we are divvying us our hotels up blue and red in this country. And frankly, it has to stop. Okay, enough. Thank you especially to Ned Foley for having me here, but also for several times traveling to Washington for our AEI Brookings election reform project. Last week, we mentioned we had a somewhat sobering event where we all left worrying about what's going to happen in 2006. And as one of the election administrators said that day, the election administrators have a prayer that includes, oh, Lord, let the margins be very large so that we don't face these problems. But the other time Ned came, we locked him in a room with 10 political scientists for the day. And now, as a political scientist in a sea of lawyers and would-be soon-to-be lawyers, I guess it's payback time. So thank you for having me. Ned Foley is doing what the court asked him not to do and looking at the precedential value of Bush v. Gore, not the first one to do so. I thought it was very helpful, some of the distinctions he made. I wanted to run through them and also take a quick look again at Bush v. Gore. I actually find myself agreeing with a lot of what Dan said. First, he makes some distinctions with some cases out there, Stewart versus Blackwell and League of Women Voters versus Blackwell, the first being a case of differential treatment of by virtue of voting machines and error rates, which he sees not as related to Bush v. Gore, and the second, more generally on this key point, which he emphasizes in Bush v. Gore, which is the standardless or vague standard aspects of election law, which then are filled in by administrators, maybe unequally. I think if you look back to Bush v. Gore, and we're trying to think about how the Roberts Court would handle this, if we're looking at the key people here, John Roberts, who has, of course, expressed an attempt to be modest in his decisions, like looking for the court to decide less and not more. Anthony Kennedy, the likely author of the opinion, also not probably looking to have explicitly not looking to have this be of wide precedential value, I think you're likely to see the decision be not taken up at every moment. So I think Ned is right that it's unlikely we're going to see an eagerness on the court to use this regularly. But I think if you go back and look at the decision, you'll find that oddly enough, the three conservatives on the court who had a concurring opinion. If you'd really wanted to go the way where there would be very little precedent, you might have gone their route. At the time, it would have been a very hardball decision. You would have overruled the Florida court. But if we went with the concurring decision of Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas, you would essentially have a precedent that would only apply probably every 124 years when things broke down in presidential elections where states overstepped by changing their election laws after the fact, it would have been a fairly narrow precedent. But I think if you look at the opinion, it was somewhat affected by that concurrence. I think one way of that the court might look at the case much more narrowly is really to look at it in a way that Dan, I think, he's partly hinted at is through the recount or after the people vote process, which would really limit it to a lot fewer activities in the equal protection area. Oddly enough, if you think about the case where people care about the most is after the election, and it's also the chance for people to be the most, for administrators to be the most abusive. When you actually, by looking at a vote, might directly decide, is it a Bush vote, is it a Gore vote, and those standardless distinctions are even more worrisome in the after election arena than they are in the pre-election arena, although they certainly can be bothersome in that way as well. Going to the, I guess I want to jump to Ned's reworking of his paper, which was a theme at the end of the paper that I read, and that is the question of how one. How the court would deal with a diversity of decisions in different circuits on Bush v. Gore. And I guess I'm not as convinced as I am by other arguments in the paper, and that is that the I think that's a too high level of generality to affect public distrust in elections. There are a lot of things out there, we can mention them, that I think will cause public distrust, but we have great variety in elections. Whether we had Bush v. Gore or not, whether we move towards nationalizing things more, the fact is that Oregon holds elections all by mail, and people vote early in Texas, and felons don't vote in some places and do in others. There are a lot of things. It would, if this principle were taken to the extreme, one would expect almost a very uniform national system. And I think more likely you'll see the court be willing to weigh in if a particular circuit gets exuberant. If somebody really comes up with a strong Bush v. Gore challenge, you may see the Supreme Court wanting to weigh in to at least maybe not define as clearly as it might the limits on the decision, but to tamp down the enthusiasm for using that as a more general principle. So the differences between the circuits, I don't think, are much different than the differences that all practices that we see among the states. To take the provisional ballot example, it may not be a wise thing if Ohio has a lot of variation in the way they implement provisional ballots, and Minnesota is very standard. But for the average person, average voter out there, I think they're less concerned about the equality between the states as they are the quality of elections in their state. And so I guess I look to four areas where I think would be we will see either litigation or worries about that could lead to lack of public confidence, and those are, again, election recounts. They're not necessarily the most common, but if you think of Florida, Washington State, Mexico, a key election that is very close, certainly this is something that leads to lack of public confidence. The sort of election screw-ups, we had one in Montgomery County right around Washington recently where people I actually don't live in Montgomery County, maybe Linda does. My county, Arlington, came out unscathed in this one, so I was happy about that. But where people showed up and weren't able to vote because of the lack of certain codes that were not brought to the machines right away, causing other cascading problems. And then generally sort of Republican versus Democratic issues, the integrity versus access issues. We see them in voter ID. We see them in felon voting. These are issues that I think are more likely to excite public attention and also litigation. And finally, I just list the last issue as I have one issue in mind. I call them strange issues, and that's the issue of paper ballots. I say they're strange because they've arisen out of all of our attempts to fix matters after 2000 in the Help America Vote Act. Not that there weren't some electronic voting machines before, but certainly the public consciousness has taken it on. But at least in terms of ideology, I don't see that as a particularly ideological issue. And we have the governor of Maryland, for some political reasons, now jumping on paper, whereas mostly it's been Democrats across the country. But whereas the voter ID issue and other issues have more of a traditional access versus integrity split, that is one that I think has cut across the political spectrum and has a strange politics to it now. But again, I think those issues and people's worries about them and the litigation that follows will bring down public confidence. But the more generalized concern about different applications of equal protection across circuits, I think, is too abstract compared to these much more concrete issues where people are people are upset about. So,
great. Thanks. One of the wonderful things about a symposium like this is to be able to present a work that's very much a work in progress, that's at an early stage, at a think piece stage, and to get such gracious and thoughtful and kind feedback that will prompt me to make changes in a very constructive way. And I can already tell that one thing that I need to do and need to think more systematically about is just how this public confidence, public distrust dynamic affects the justices' internal thinking about a cert petition. Because I think, to me, it's not a direct, it's not like there's a public opinion poll that says, oh, we don't like the circuit conflict over Bush versus Gore, and it registers once it gets to 40% lack of, you know, that then influences the judge's thinking. It seems to me it's a more complicated psychological process about how you think about existing public distrust about the election system generally. Any marginal increase in distrust caused by Bush versus Gore issues, combined with marginal increase of just Bush versus Gore being a hot potato, combined with perhaps this irony point. So I think the next draft of the paper ought to be more systematic in my presentation of it in terms of what the, you know, again, the thing about the cert granting process is there are no rules. And, of course, there's no explanation unless you see a dissent from a denial or, you know, rarely another kind of separate writing that explains the internal deliberations on any a cert decision. So it's speculative. But I do think folks who follow the court and who think about, you know, patterns of cert granting, you know, have some instinct about how the court thinks about cert petitions. And I think the next draft of the paper should try to be more systematic about that and then tie that psychology into the public perception relation. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about that in terms of Q&A. But I want to come back to a point that both Dan and John made. And by the way, as John was speaking, Dan passed this perfect note, which is said, John 48 looks just like John Roberts. So we have John Roberts right here. He can tell us what the court's thinking is on all of this. So you're two roles. You're a political scientist, and you are the Roberts Court.
No, he can tell us about the appearance of it.
Again, you know, I'm less interested, as I explained, in terms of what the right answer on Bush versus Gore is, what's the right way to understand it, than how the lower courts will actually treat it descriptively. And I think the very violent, almost, disagreement between the majority and the dissent and the panel opinion in the Stewart voting machine case, which is just a, you know, extreme example of the war of footnotes and just the caustic language. And now this, again, it's the Sixth Circuit, and you know, it's only one panel. But I suspect that's an indication that we're going to see lower courts disagree, even if Dan has the right interpretation. The true interpretation, or that John, for example, is correct about the instincts of where the Roberts Court would be. And the only other thought on provisional voting. Is I can imagine actually a lot of specific issues that come within the context that Dan's identified in terms of the judicial, the after-the-fact judicial process statewide. In other words, you have, I mean, after all, Bush versus Gore comes up using the election contest procedure in Florida, and you have a recount ordered pursuant to that invocation of that statutory remedy. That statutory remedy could easily be invoked in terms of figure out what do we do with provisional ballots, count them or don't count them. That statutory remedy could be invoked, excuse me, in terms of how do we handle a mismatch between the electronic machine count and what the paper trail says, or what do you do if 10% or 5% of the paper ballots are smudged. So I think we could see quite a few fact patterns that don't involve CHADS but do involve judicially supervised recounts that concern this issue of disparity as a result of administrative discretion implementing an unspecified standard, because you could have the state court saying, hey, our state law tells us with respect to provisional ballot, here's what you're supposed to do. We issue an order on November 27th to start looking at these provisional ballots, and yet, because it's unspecified. So, I mean, it does cut the likelihood down if you have to narrow Bush versus Gore to a context where the judicial contest procedure is invoked, but scenarios could develop along those lines. And then again, I guess
The main point is the lower courts are going to have to make a judgment about whether or not it's that confined or it's not. You know, one, just to throw out one more aspect of this, I think we're going to see a lot of litigation over the failure to follow rules, right? Bush versus Gore was about insufficiently specified rules. What if the rules are specified, but the election administration officials don't follow them? ID rules, other rules about, you know, polling place procedures and so forth. It seems to me it's easy to write an opinion distinguishing that fact pattern from the Bush versus Gore precedent. It only applies when you have vague rules. It doesn't apply when the legislature writes a clear rule and the folks don't follow it. That's not a Bush versus Gore issue. You lose. But I can see a counterargument to that as a matter, you know, why should it matter if there's discriminatory disenfranchisement? It means state law has not provided a remedy when state officials violate their own laws. The consequence to voters is as severe as if it's an insufficiently specified standard. There ought to be relief in that analogous context. And I think lower court judges are going to debate about that. And you're going to have aggressive lower court judges like the Sixth Circuit panel and Stewart who say, we would like to make liberal Bush versus Gore precedent. And I do think there's going to be a slapping down function. I do think it is more likely that the court will intervene quicker to slap down a lower court for granting relief. I think it's never going to take a case that denies relief. And so part of the unknown is how quickly a case will arise that grants relief. I think the Sixth Circuit en banc is going to reverse the panel, so I don't think it's going to come up in Stewart. I don't know, though, that the court is going to take the first case that grants relief under Bush versus Gore. That seems to me we need to know more about the facts. If it's a very systemic ruling that seems to upset state policy, yes, I think they intervene. If it could be a small race, not a big race, a small race, pretty narrow fact pattern, I could see the court wanting to let that conflict develop. Let me stop there.
Which do you think is more likely than the case of one exuberant circuit and the court striking it down, or worries about the different application of Bush v. Gore among the states? I mean, I guess my argument was that, to me, for the public outcry would not be so great in that case. Of the differing circuits of application, because we've got so many other things that are different, so many other practices are different, so hard to figure out even what anybody else is doing in any other state except, you know, in a presidential election contest. In the state of Washington had all sorts of problems. People got worked up in Washington, but except for a few people, others weren't following it and thinking about how exactly in their state their particular situations are going to apply, and they had, you know, very different, they had lots of things that would be hard to transfer to other situations. Which is more likely, this cutting down the circuit that really puts up Bush v. Gore, or worries about the conflict of circuits over the interpretation of Bush v. Gore?
I think you're right. I think that higher in the justices' minds would be to cut down the exuberant circuit. I do think that's right. And so I think if we see an exuberant circuit, that would accelerate the grant. I do think it's an interesting dynamic, and I do talk about it in the paper a little bit and didn't discuss it today, is what's the balance between just putting aside the irony point, putting aside the public distrust point, what's the balance in the justice's mind between the desire to slap down an exuberant circuit and the desire not to touch Bush versus Gore with a 10-foot pole for as long as you can avoid it? Those cut in opposite directions, and I could see the court waiting longer than it otherwise might simply because it's going to be controversial. And I think the justices will know that even if the majority of the court is of the slapping down mentality, there are going to be some justices on the court that will want to claim hypocrisy. And there'll be some strong dissent. You know, it's very unlikely that the next Bush versus Gore case is going to be a unanimous decision saying we now, nine justices, collectively agree as to what Bush v. Gore means going forward. You know, look at gerrymandering, look at all the other areas where we see fracture. So if the court knows that it's a hot potato and that's, and so therefore taking the case in, going to be a dissent, going to claim hypocrisy, going to claim you can't trust this court to be neutral on election law. You know, it's a fiction that they are able to decide these equal protection claims in a way that's impartial. Keep it away. Keep it away. So that's why I think the conflict could develop, and that's what led to the speculation about. And it may be that the public distrust factor nor the irony factor get that much weight. And it may be then it just festers. And that would mean that it would fester for a long, long time. And then we have to ask, does timing affect? In other words, if it festers, does that affect in any way public confidence? And maybe the answer is no. There's just too much else on the public's mind involving election. You know, then it just means 5 decades before we know the answer to these questions.
Okay, yeah. If you'd signal to me, and I'll keep, let's start with Rick Hassan, and then I'll let me know. I'll write, get a list here. But go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, I really enjoyed your paper. As I listened to the discussion, I'm hearing that there are these empirical questions that are empirical assumptions you're making, the ones we've been discussing about public confidence. And I just point you to some of the data that the National Election Studies put together on public confidence, which shows the gap that nationally Democrats have much less confidence than Republicans. But studies out of Washington State, for example, showed that after the gubernatorial contest there, Republicans have much less confidence than Democrats, showing that the losers after election battles are the ones who tend to have less confidence. Rather than being an inter-circuit split that's causing it, it's did my guy lose in the courts, which is undermining confidence. But I want to go to another one of your critical assumptions, which is that clarity from the Supreme Court would lower the amount of litigation, which would therefore increase public confidence. And I'm not sure that that's right. So let's assume you're right, that the court decides to get involved to stop the irrational exuberance of a Stewart v. Blackwell majority kind of opinion. And comes in and says Bush versus Gore is limited to, the way Dan said, a very narrow set of circumstances involving judicial decisions as opposed to the broader protection or discretion reading. So what would that mean? I think that would mean we would still have a great deal of election litigation. So I did a study of the pre and post Bush versus Gore election challenges that have been brought, and we see something like a 250% increase in election challenges. But if you look at the cases that are brought, very few of them actually present Bush versus Gore claims. That is, Bush versus Gore had a direct effect of creating this new equal protection cause of action, whatever it is, but also the indirect effect of making it more likely that people are going to go to court and challenge election. So take voter ID. You could take voter ID cases and make Bush versus Gore claims. Look, the elderly or the Amish or Native Americans, they don't have birth certificates that they can use to get this, and this is treating one person's vote over another. You can make those kind of claims, but if that's taken out, you'll still bring the claim and you'll cast it as a, it violates classic. Everyone has the right to cast a vote and have it counted. Or it violates Harper, it's a poll test. And so I think even if we got perfect clarity, even if the Supreme Court shut down Bush versus Gore, the cheese out of the bottle, we would still see a tremendous amount of election litigation. And if that's what's undermining public confidence, I don't think the slapdown's going to do much to stop.
I would modify that in one small respect, and that is I think it's not even Bush versus Gore, it's the Florida controversy. If the Supreme Court has said this is not the business of the Supreme Court, and it's been settled however it would have been settled, I think you would be seeing the same thing. It's just the parties decided this is part of the war we fight.
Yeah, I was using Bush versus Gore as a shorthand for the vote.
Rather, yeah, let's just get more comments. And
two questions. One is to Ned. I want to press a comment that John made in a more pointed way, which is to get at your view of the relationship between this sort of public intuition that there should be fairness or equality in the voting process, at least within a state, and the Bush v. Gore decision itself, because there could be two very different stories that one might tell about that. One story is that the public has this intuition about fairness and equality in the vote. It's only as we've gotten to much closer elections and they've been put under the microscope, the people have become more aware of these problems, but that's what's created a lot of, or brought to the surface, this intuitive sense of fairness and equality with respect to the vote. And that Bush v. Gore is actually a reflection of that. Okay? Or your story could be Bush v. Gore created this public sense that there must be fairness and equality in the way votes are treated within a state in a single election. Now, I actually think the Bush v. Gore created it story is not very plausible to me, although I think the paper sort of suggests that. But I think part of what John was saying is that maybe the way to understand your point is that if this intuition is there and has been revealed by close elections, whether through the Florida litigation or in some other way, I mean, it casts an interesting perspective on Bush v. Gore itself, right? Because that makes it seem more like a reflection of some general intuitive sense of what it means to treat votes fairly and equally in a statewide election process. So there's actually a lot at stake in thinking about Bush v. Gore itself and one's reaction to it in the choice of whether you see this public demand as pre-existing Bush v. Gore or as having been created by the decision. That's one point. Just, I don't know, second small point about Anthony Kennedy, if we talk about individual justices here, because you two conflicted about your view of Kennedy, I think John and Ned did. Whether the court stays away or an individual justice stays away from this kind of issue is partly a function of whether they feel embarrassed by the vote or not. And if you picture justices who think maybe we did something unseemly, you can imagine wanting to keep as far away from it as possible. I don't have any sense that that's the way Kennedy thinks about it. Quite to the contrary, he said many times in public settings he does not view that as one of his more difficult votes. He views his vote in Casey as a much more difficult vote than his vote in Bush v. Gore. If you look at Kennedy's jurisprudence as a whole in this area, whether it's in the gerrymandering context or others, he's always been someone who's had this impulse to bring some kind of civility or orderly process, you know, to the democratic system. You know, as I've written, the court's decision in Bush v. Gore is of a piece with its decision in cases quite removed from vote counting, like regulating the blanket primary and things like that. And I don't see Kennedy as embarrassed. I, in fact, would think of him as maybe eager to show that Bush v. Gore does reflect a real principle of law. So there are assumptions here about how justices relate to their work and their decision-making in that case that are worth unpacking a little bit more, I would say. Just those two comments.
Passage for today,
I agree with many of the comments, but it seems to me the key to the course future behavior isn't so much Kennedy. I agree with Rick that Kennedy has no second thoughts. I think the second thoughts may come from Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, Alito, who may be scared to death of the launching of this equal protection doctrine. I mean, why did they have that famous line in there, won't be cited in any future case? Because, you know, they had to get an opinion out. They didn't have five votes for the Chiefs, Article II, separate writing, obviously. Kennedy and O'Connor, for whatever reason, weren't going to sign that, so they needed a vehicle that would get five votes. And they came, you know, they launched this equal protection idea. And I think they certainly don't want it to be landing like little cluster bombs all over the electoral landscape. So I think it's not implausible that they would take a case to cabinet. Of course, the irony of Bush against Gore creating Bush against Gore, there's also an irony that, at least, Ned, as you formulated the holding of Bush against Gore, that the problem was the discriminatory impact of the differential standard or the unspecific standard. Well, you know, what about discriminatory impact in an equal protection analysis? You know, the last I checked, they needed discriminatory intent. And so it's a doctrine that really has no place in the court's current jurisprudence. And I think it'd be, as for reasons people have said, be very easy to take a case and kind of distinguish Bush against Gore away and send a message that, you know, we didn't really mean what it may have looked like we meant.
Can I jump back in real quick? This is all wonderful. I think the focusing on Kennedy and the dynamic of the justices just for a second, you know, my best guess, if you poll, you know, if your case got there today and how they actually would decide, I think many potential claims would lose because I don't think Kennedy is going to think it's the widest possible precedent. But I also think he, for reasons that at least a couple of people have suggested, he likes his decision. I think he wants to be principled. I think he would give it a little bit of leg room. In other words, it's going to have some principle that's going to be beyond the most narrowest understanding of the case. And I think the liberals on the court would like, you know, I think they'd enjoy using it to create some liberal equal protection law. So there's going to be an interesting dynamic about what, you know, what the precedent means and what to do with it. I think a lot of equal protection cases are decided on justices' gut reactions to the, you know, intuition to the facts, and then you rationalize whatever theory you want afterward. And that's not true just of Bush versus Gore, but it's, you know, it's Shaw versus Reno, it's yada, yada, yada. And so if we see a fact pattern where it looks like real disenfranchisement has occurred because some state officials are bollocksing up the voter ID rules or the database, you know, then you're going to see liberals on the court, two of whom already agreed with the equal protection holding in Bush versus Gore itself, say, we got an equal protection problem. We've got to extend this precedent. And Kennedy might be sympathetic because he wants to show principle. Some justices want to slap it down to some extent, but this is a rich, complicated story. And for that reason, Sam, I think doctrine matters. I mean, I agree with everything that you said about just courts are open for business, new dynamic. I think it feeds into Rick Hassan's point about, you know, it's not just the direct effect, it's the indirect effect. But I think the doctrine does matter because there are going to be perceived injustices on the ground in close elections where the outcome of the election depends on which way you go on Bush versus Gore. Democrats, Republicans, they're all going to be upset. And so it's going to matter, does it extend this far or not this far? So I think both points are important. I'm not as sanguine about the Mexico situation as you portray it to be, although I have no firsthand knowledge, but I don't know that that country is all at peace as a result of their and have great public confidence as a result of the process, although I haven't read headlines in the last week to 10 days about riots in the streets, so I just don't know. But question mark on Mexico.
I can make one quick point on Kennedy. I'm speculating more wildly probably than several of you, but I don't think he's embarrassed by his opinion, but I'm not sure which part of it he's not embarrassed by, whether it's the equal protection holding or the limited character of it. And at least compared to the redistricting cases where he's clearly saying, casting about, please find something for me, find a standard. It doesn't have that character, or it doesn't seem to call out that we need to expand this, and so I'm not certain that that's what's in his heart. There may be other cases that do fit in a limited framework, but I think he'd probably be comfortable with both the limitation and the equal protection.
Thank you. I think Sam makes a really powerful point about Bush versus Gore being more significant from an institutional perspective than from a doctrinal. Similar to the point Rick Hassan had made earlier. I do nevertheless want to bring it back to doctrine for a second. And what I found most helpful about your paper, Ned, was teasing out these two different ways of reading Bush versus Gore for me that I think I've sometimes confused in my own mind. One is the dimension that we see most prominently in the Stewart versus Blackwell case, which, in the interest of disclosure, I've worked on along with my co-counsel Paul Mokey and Rich Sapphire, who are here, which focuses on statistically provable inter-county disparities. The other is the dimension that I think the League of Women Voters case focuses on, that the Shearing case, which you also mentioned, focuses on, and which I have focused on in my scholarship, the standardless discretion aspect of Bush versus Gore. Now, I guess I'm not terribly persuaded, like Dan and John, by your point about there being a Bush versus Gore problem if there's a circuit split on how we read Bush versus Gore, so long as there's consistency within a state. But I think there actually has been a fair amount of consistency thus far in how the courts have read Bush versus Gore. And, you know, the differences, as say, between the Wexler case and the Stewart case have more to do with the facts, whether you've actually proven a disparity is between counties, and the courts have thus far tended towards the first view, the inter-county statistical disparity view, as opposed to the second. And I guess my question is, first of all, whether you agree and why that is. Is it for the reasons that Sam suggests that these cases, you know, arise at the last minute? Maybe that's a part of it, but I'm not sure that explains why we've seen so relatively little litigation on the standardless discretion aspect of Bush versus Gore.
I guess I see more litigation out there maybe than you do, in the sense that it is true that the only issue that's gotten sort of to the level of the circuit courts of appeals is the statistical disparity in the machine context. But, you know, I think in state courts and lower state courts, there's been a fair amount of the standardless discretion kind. Again, none of it doesn't always necessarily go up. It didn't go up in Washington. It didn't go up in Ohio because, you know, it petered out. So I still think it's very early on. I mean, you know, 2000 was the decision. It's only 2006. You need elections. You need close elections for some of these claims to generate. I think there is there's a couple of things that we haven't really talked about that I think are actually quite interesting about Bush versus Gore. One is, you know, there's some areas of law, including election law, where the ratio of Supreme Court precedent to lower court precedent is high. There's other areas of law where that ratio is lower. You know, in other words, you know, and I'm just going to throw out some examples and where they would fall on the spectrum, I don't know. But, you know, death penalty, how many death penalty cases are there in the lower court compared to the Supreme Court? Search and seizure cases, how many ballot access cases? So in each sort of area of the law, there's variability to how much that doctrine, that body of law, is controlled by really overarching Supreme Court cases versus that the law takes on a life of its own in the lower courts. And I think, you know, it's open to interesting discussion about what will be the law of equal protection in voting administration. It seems to me there is a good chance that over the next half century, that's going to be, for reasons that maybe Sam is referring to, that's going to be a law created largely in the lower courts, and we're only beginning to see that develop with very little intervention both in terms of number of Supreme Court cases and the effect that those Supreme Court cases have on doctrine if they're very narrow. So less Supreme Court control compared to maybe some other areas of the law. Something to think about. The other thing that I think is important, Rick Hassan alluded to, is, you know, Bush versus Gore is not the only equal protection case. I mean, we've got Harper, voter ID is going to get decided ultimately. There's going to be an equal protection holding that's not going to directly implicate Bush versus Gore. So, you know, if it takes two decades for the court to take one of these cases, the overall landscape of equal protection law is going to be different, and some of it's actually going to be election administration law, and that's going to color the future of Bush versus Gore in I think, interesting ways. And then finally, but I won't go into it, I think the taxonomy of Bush versus Gore, as I hopefully will suggest even more in the next draft, is larger than just the dichotomy that was in the paper initially and that Dan refers to. I actually think we can develop a richer taxonomy that at least has four subcategories and maybe more. And you know, we'll be back 10 years from now talking about Bush versus Gore and what it means. It'll be sort of an interesting to take these decade-by-decade measures of the law of equal protection and to see how much our predictions are correct or not.
My point is similar to Sam, so slightly varied, which is I think it's not so. Partly, I agree with him completely about the sort of the lowering of the procedural barriers. But in some ways, what comes out to me about the importance of Bush versus Gore, again, it's doctrinal, but maybe at a more meta level, which I think is that these are issues of constitutional moment. These issues of election mechanics and election administration are of constitutional significance. It doesn't mean that that specific procedures are unconstitutional, but it means that you're stating a claim. You're stating a claim of some significance, which is why it connects to the proliferation of litigation. But it has to be mapped against a context in which, until now 2000 plus, we had for 200 years accepted, and still accept, state-based systems, locally administered, 50 states plus D.C., 3,000 plus counties. It's a system where there's a huge amount of variation is inherently built in. Part of it is the nature of the rules, and as you point out, some of them, how do we exactly verify a ballot? What are the rules? Can you crisp up rules for that? But it's also the system we've created is this very decentralized system. And one can imagine the problem here is, having said this is constitutional, that these are constitutional claims, it may not be that either the Supreme Court or we, whoever we are, want to have a system of total uniformity. See how easily we move toward it. We don't want to have a court-ordered system of uniformity against a context of 200 years of political practices of great decentralization. So I think as cases emerge, there'll be a better sense of what the issues are and where is uniformity, where there are egregious violations of these basic values of equal treatment and non-arbitrariness, which are, we can debate as to which one Bush versus Gore really was. In some sense, it's degrees of both, that there are outer limits of unequal treatment, there are outer limits of arbitrariness, and of course that was a presidential election, so it was not an election of great moment. But that it's about getting a sense of, as the issues emerge, what is a constitutional claim, but one that may not rise to the level of national judicial treatment, which could be handled either by district courts, courts of appeals, state courts, political actors. As these issues become more and more salient, you may get state legislative responses, or you are getting state legislative responses, congressional responses. And I think that's why I think clarification actually is not so much the issue. And I certainly don't, I sort of agree with the criticism. I don't think the public cares at the level of, gee, Michigan has one rule and Missouri has another. I think they're completely oblivious to that, as are most lawyers and most academics. But I think it's a sense of now that we've said for the first time, in that sense it's like a Baker versus Carr, it's like the first time the court said that vote dilution as opposed to individual voting rights is a problem, or these early issues about gerrymandering. This is now a matter of constitutional moment, constitutional significance. But in a world in which we're either unlikely to truly equalize across the board, we're not going to have nationally administered elections. We're probably not going to have state administered elections. How do we hold these two ideas together? And a generation of cases and a generation of district court, court of appeals, state Supreme Court opinions, followed by some new state legislation, followed by changes in Board of Elections rules, is probably what we're going to get. And maybe as some particularly egregious things emerge, those might get slapped down or accepted, I suppose, at a higher level. We'll get a sense of it. I'm not as troubled by the lack of certainty. I think we need to know more about, A, what the problems are, which I think you've done a great job of beginning the process of identifying them, but B, figuring out what's the acceptable level of variation in a system where we begin with a huge level of variation. I think we need to find that out.
Just to follow on that a little, Help America Vote Act certainly was not a time argument. So I got a question for
you. Professor Charles had a question, and we're at the time we're supposed to be heading over, so people
I'll just be very quick. I guess it's sort of follow up to on Richard's in a slightly different direction. One wonders whether we haven't seen the effects of Bush v. Gore and the campaign finance and redistricting, et cetera, cases, right? And once the court has gone that far in Bush v. Gore, then in some senses, the floodgates are already open such that you can begin to explore in ways that you're seeing Kennedy and Vietnam, right, and Gulag, et cetera, explore other related, not the same, but other election-type questions. So it seems, it might be one way of looking for the effects of Bush v. Gore is to look for like cases, right, at the district court level, et cetera. But another way, on the Supreme Court, might also think about having expanded the elasticity of what the court is capable of thinking about in these cases, is that their willingness in cases that are not quite similar but within that same generation or family that enables greater adventuresome from the court than you would see otherwise prior to that venture.
I'm
going
to have to draw
it
to the truth. We have time while we're walking over to the lunch, and time while we're walking back, and I want to make a quick comment about coming back. Those of us who are coming back to this space need to know that we have a huge crowd of people going in various directions. So we need to make our way back by the, what is our start time? 1:30 time over here. So you'll be on your own. You'll know the dismissal of the group to get back.
Perfect. Thank you, everybody, for your comments. I appreciate them. Thanks, co-panelists.